Our first case is 09-1735, Larry Engel versus the University of Toledo College of Medicine. Ms. Shermer.
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the Court. If I may, I'd like to please reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The question in this case is whether a purely private physician serving as a volunteer instructor for a state medical school is a state officer or employee entitled to immunity under revised code 9.86. The answer is no, these volunteers are not immune, and that's for two key reasons. First, they're not state officers because the term appointed position in 109.36A1A refers only to positions created by law, and the volunteer program here simply doesn't fit that bill. Second, these volunteers are not employed by the university. The doctor here concedes that. He has no employment contract with the university. He receives no university salary or benefits, and the university has no control or financial connection to his private practice. These individuals are simply volunteers who allow medical students to come in and observe their private practices. The analysis begins, Your Honors, as always, with the language of the statute, which in this case is 109.36A1A.
Counsel, let me ask if the students that are in there to observe the physician in their private practice, is that arranged through the school, or is that something the student does on their own?
It's a combination. The mechanics of it, that information is not developed through the record, but it's partly arranged through the school and it's partly determined by the student's interest. So I'd say it's sort of a hybrid.
So is it a requisite that a student observe a physician as part of their curriculum?
Doing clinical rotations are part of the educational curriculum, and it varies depending upon what the student's interests would be, whether they are going to do a certain kind of rotation through the employed clinical faculty, through the volunteer faculty. For most students, I think it's safe to say, Your Honor, it's some combination of both. It's largely the employed clinical faculty, but there will be some areas of specialty or their opportunity to observe, for instance, the practice of medicine out in more rural counties, that these volunteers provide the opportunity for the medical students to go and observe. I think the issue, though, in terms of the question of whether they're actually a state officer or employee, ultimately turns on a different question, and it's the question of whether that position is one created by law. The text that we're looking at here is this 109.36A1A, which is at page 19 of the appendix accompanying the university's brief, in case that's helpful.
Is any university professor anywhere an officer of the state?
I don't think so, Your Honors. I think
so
they are.
Any faculty member at Ohio State is not a state officer?
No. Not that I'm aware of. And in fact, nobody here in this case has ever presented another example of some sort of position under state law wherein the person is not employed by the university.
Is Gordon Gee a state officer?
He's not, Your Honor. He's an employee of the university.
Not even Jim Tressel.
Not even Jim Tressel, Your Honors.
You have a hard case with that, Ms. Sherman.
Actually, the only people who are officially state officers who are affiliated with the universities are the trustees, and they are officers by virtue of statutes. 3364.01 is the statute that confers officer status
on
the trustees.
What would be the status, then, of one who holds a faculty appointment at a university, a
state
university?
They are employees of the university, Your Honor. They have employment contracts. They receive salary and benefits from
the
university.
Can they be volunteer employees?
No. I am not aware of any situation where you have a volunteer employee. All you would have are officers, employees, or volunteers. And we know that from other texts in the General Assembly. If we put aside for a moment, I'll come back to it, the statute that's at issue here. But we know from other provisions in the Ohio Revised Code that the General Assembly views volunteers as categorically different from officers and employees, which is exactly your question, Your Honor. It's 1501.23 is an example whereby the Department of Natural Resources director is authorized to appoint or designate volunteers as employees for purposes of immunity. A similar situation in 5907.12 for the Department of Veteran Affairs. There would be no reason for the General Assembly to confer a special power on these directors to specially designate these volunteers as employees if, Justice O'Donnell, they could otherwise somehow fall under the definition of employee or officer. And there are other examples as well.
But counsel, Have you gone back and looked at the argument that Mr. Crawford made for the Attorney General's office in the Theobald case?
I have seen it in the past, Your Honor.
Okay. And have you looked at the brief that the Attorney General's office filed in that case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Let me read to you from the front of the brief, the outline of the issues presented. Defendant Appellee, University of Cincinnati, Proposition Law 1. An individual serving on the faculty of a state-run medical school is an employee of the medical school under RC 109.36A, so that the individual is immune from civil liability under RC 9.86 unless the individual's actions are manifestly outside the scope of employment. That's your first proposition of law.
I don't think that that's at all contradictory with what's being said here, Your Honor. It's possible that the language in that proposition of law was imprecise. I think what it was getting at, and if you read the brief and if you look at what the arguments that the university is making.
I did. I watched it again last night.
Okay,
it's fascinating. It's totally the opposite argument from the one you're making today.
No, Your Honor. It's not. It's not the opposite argument at all. The only way that these two things are contradictory is if you view physicians who are employees of the university as being identical to the physicians who serve as volunteer instructors, and they're not. And let me explain.
So which doctor in Theobald was an employee of the university?
Your Honor, when the case came up before this court in Theobald, all of the physicians at issue there were employees.
They were employees of a private practice plan.
No, Your Honor, the case, as Justice Stratton wrote in her opinion, she made clear, when that case came up to this court, it was already the law of the case that all four of those individuals were employees of the university. It wasn't a question that was even before the court. Theobald simply involved the second question, which was scope of immunity.
The doctors in Theobald were the employees. The key doctor was the employee of the Mayfield practice plan. Mayfield was a private for-profit corporation. And in your brief, in that case, you outlined the fact that because of the nature of those corporations, the corporations didn't even pay Social Security tax. And I assume nobody was paying into PERS. The docs themselves were paying all of that as private members of a practice plan.
Your Honor, I don't think there's ever been a case in which the details of the practice plans and the relationships between employed clinicians and the universities have been fully fleshed out. I think there are a lot of misperceptions out there, but let me try to address some of them. Physicians who are employees of the university, they have employment contracts with the university, they receive salary and benefits from the university, they practice through authorized practice plans of the university whose terms are approved and dictated by the university.
I think in that case it was agreed that the key doctors paid more to the university than the university paid to them, or their practice plan paid more to the university.
All that does is confirm.
The docs didn't get any individual checks at all.
All that does, Your Honor, though, is confirm their status as an employee, that their actual work, their responsibilities toward the university were to treat patients on behalf of the university. I want to go back to the specific question, though, of what the word appointed position means here, because that's the question presented in this case. And I want to make several textual points and one contextual point. First of all, the way to determine what the word position means in this case is that it has to be construed in light of its position relative to the rest of the words in A1A. The word position appears in the broader phrase, is the person serving in an elected or appointed office or position with the state. So the terms office or position are paired together, and that pairing should be given weight. It's the iustem generis canon, where there are two terms that are paired together, especially where a general one, like the word position, follows a very specialized and specific one, like the word office. The word that is the general word, position, should be construed as being in the same class or category as the word office. So what does the word office mean, for starters? Office is a very specialized governmental term of art. The Ohio Constitution establishes the governor, the attorney general.
Counsel, help us out. How on earth does someone representing someone who has been injured as a result of medical negligence figure out the difference between the docs in Theobald and the doc here? I read from page 15 of your brief. Now, I'm not going back to Crawford's brief. Dr. How do you say his last name? Help me.
Soskowitz.
Soskowitz was not performing the procedures at issue pursuant to any duties. He was operating on his own patient from his own private practice in a private not-for-profit hospital. A state university medical student happened to be observing these procedures at the time changes none of that. Now, I can't for the life of me figure out how that's different than the docs in Theobald. They were their own patients. Theobald was the doc's own patient from his private practice in a private, not-for-profit hospital, which UC's hospital was private, not-for-profit hospital. It wasn't University of Cincinnati. So here we have these two parallel cases. How is any lawyer supposed to figure out where you bring suit?
The discovery process will answer that question, Your Honor, and it's the common practice is that you file
the
common pleas.
Theobald, the answer was filed after the statute of limitations ran, and then your office took the position, tough luck.
That's not true. That's not what the timing was, Your Honor. By the time the immunity defense was alleged in Theobald, there was still sufficient time for the doctor's lawyer to file the case in the Court of Claims. The appellate
Crawford
court
stood right there and said, the answer was filed after the statute of limitations ran.
Your Honor, as the appellate court, the 10th District in Theobald, paragraph 12 of its opinion wrote, the plaintiff's lawyer in Theobald had sufficient time to know that he should have filed in the Court of Claims.
Okay, so what about the lawyer here?
So then the discovery process would have answered that question. I agree with you. There's no way anybody would have known that here because the doctor's not an officer or employee of the state. So let me turn back to the question of the officer.
But if we say it was,
I don't think the perception of the patient matters.
He's out of court, isn't he?
Your Honor, the perception of the patient doesn't matter in these cases. You have to do the analysis of whether the person is an officer or employee.
Well, let me ask you. They allege what we should do is allow Rule 15C to enable someone who timely files a medical negligence claim to jump over to the Court of Claims if we determine that Justice Wright and Judge Klatt, who has been pushing this expanded liability for the state, if we agree with them, his client is out of luck unless we find some mechanism for them to save the day because they timely filed in the common pleas court in the local jurisdiction.
The court, Your Honor, doesn't have the authority to create a mechanism to save the day.
Well, what about 15C? He argues that 15C saves the day.
The limitations period in this case is statutory, and the court doesn't have the authority to apply 15C.
So all of the folks who were caught by Theobald when it was announced, who had filed in the local courts, and you would acknowledge that the 10th District engaged in a sea change in Theobald, would you not?
Not at all, Your Honor. I do not read Justice Stratton's opinion as any sort of a sea change.
No,
I read
her opinion wasn't. She just, this court approved of what the 10th District did.
No,
and Judge Shoemaker laid out Theobald as, in that case, the docs were not immune. The 10th District said, we're going to change the way we've been evaluating this, and we're going to evaluate it by, is teaching going on? And in this case, I think it's stipulated teaching was going on, is it not?
There is teaching going on. Your Honor, I think the factual assumptions behind your questions are wrong, with all due respect. I think the epilogue to Theobald is as unfortunate as anybody else insofar as he was not able to pursue his claim. But I think, as all the courts who examined the issue made clear, it doesn't have anything to do with any legal error that inhered in the Theobald decision itself. Theobald was a plain vanilla application of the immunity analysis.
But according to the briefs, Engel did file in Henry County, and the trial court has stayed that action. And then they went and filed in the Court of Claims. So in this case, if that case was actually filed and stayed, I don't see that you have the problem Theobald encountered. Am I missing something about the filings?
I think if Your Honors are reversing the 10th District's opinion, no, that this Mr. Engel can go back to the Court of Claims and he can pursue his case. So I think you're right, Your Honor.
Wait a minute. You said if we reverse the 10th District said it's immune, and the proper place is the Court of Claims.
Right, and if we reverse the 10th District, there is no immunity. He revives his action that's been stayed in the Henry County Common Pleas Court.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And I want to emphasize that every other party in this case has acknowledged that Theobald is irrelevant, that the questions that Your Honor is presenting, I know they present questions that perhaps are relevant to the atmosphere of things that followed Theobald, but that they are not actually relevant to the issues in this case.
If you're teaching and you're appointed to the faculty of the Toledo Medical College, you're not immune.
Volunteers are not immune, Your Honor. The difference between employees and volunteers is stark. It is set out in our brief. And the question of whether someone is appointed to a position in the state, let me analogize for one moment. I see I'm low on time, but if
you're
I could just...
way over time. I'll give you 15 seconds.
If I can address, it's not dissimilar to the court's new lawyer-to-lawyer mentoring program, where private lawyers volunteer to tutor, mentor new attorneys in the practice. You sign up, you get a letter from the court saying you've been selected, appointed as a mentor. You receive a handbook with extensive requirements, submission deadlines, and timelines. The private lawyers who volunteer to serve those functions arguably are important. They're not state officers, but to find that the appointed position here satisfies the definition of being an appointed office or employee
of the state. Is it your view that this is a case about whether or not the physician was an employee of the university or served in a volunteer capacity? Is that the only issue that you're presenting to us?
I think that's basically the issue. He concedes that he's not employed by the university, and the question is he a state officer? And I know of no state officer position that isn't one that is created by law. This is not a position created by law.
And your view is to distinguish the Theobald case because there the physician involved was an employee of the university.
Correct, Your Honor. That case came up to this court as with the law of the case being that all of those physicians are employees.
And so you factually distinguish the two because one was an employee and this individual in this case was a volunteer who was instructing at the university.
That's correct.
However, we use the term volunteer very broadly because he is paid. There's a payment that goes to the physician per student. There is an approval process by the Board of Trustees. And so he's not just a volunteer that the student goes and knocks on the door and says, can I come and observe your procedure? There is a process that the university gives their stamp of approval. And there is a payment, even if there's a minimal payment. And to Justice Pfeiffer's point, at what point do you become an employee? Is it the amount of the payment? Is it the fact that it was only $275? I'm really not seeing the distinction here.
Well, one very important point, Your Honor, is that the payment doesn't come from the university. It is a stipend that is granted by a private nonprofit organization that is trying to encourage volunteers to perform this function. So he is not paid by the university at all. There are no W-2s. He has no employment contract. He is not paid by the university. And I think the distinction is really actually very clear that the employed physicians they operate through university practice plans that are controlled by the university. They are subject to the medical staff bylaws, which control treatment protocols. And I see my time's
up. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Schimmer. Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, members of the court, counsel. My name is John Fisher. I'm here representing Larry Engel, and I'm proud to be here in that capacity.
Am I correct in that if we reverse, this case does go back to the common pleas. Is your action on stay there?
That is correct.
So the issues raised by the amicus really don't apply. They may have a general issue with statute of limitations and Theobald, but that is not present in this case.
Which amicus are you referring to? Because if you're referring to the Ohio Association for
right.
Justice, then you're correct.
Okay.
Not if you're referring to Dr. Skoskevich.
Okay.
All right. In our brief to the court, I argued, first of all, we switched positions, as I'm sure this court is aware. You've read the briefs. That switch in positions was premised and based entirely upon the decision in Theobald III, which is, I hope the court appreciates my numbering system, the remanded decision by the 10th District Court of Appeals. That was another sea change, if you will, to borrow the Attorney General's term, in how case law is to be interpreted and statutes of limitations are to be applied. When this court remanded Theobald when it was before this court. I don't think it was within the contemplation of these your justices that you were sending Keith Theobald back to certain death of his claim.
Well, it should have been, because if you watch the oral arguments, I asked those very questions of Mr. Crawford from the Attorney General's office, and he said, time's up. I mean, he first danced around it, but I pinned him down. And then the rest of the court examined him at length about whether or not folks that were in the category of so-called employee, and I'm still having a hard time figuring out how you become an employee or how you're not an employee, that all of their patients, Chief Justice O'Connor asked questions, Justice Stratton asked questions, Justice Lansinger, and the Attorney General at that time took the position, even if a resident or student wasn't present, immunity would still apply to these doctors who don't get a check from the university. They're working in a practice plan. Immunity would apply at all times because they were required to see a lot of patients to keep their skills up, was the answer at that time. But he very clearly indicated that the state was going to take the position, if the case had to be brought in the Court of Claims, that Theobald was out of luck.
I wish I'd have seen that argument.
Well, you can.
I did not.
It's preserved for everybody to watch. My question about this is, the assumption here is that we're going to reverse. If we affirm, is your client out of luck due to the statute of limitations?
It would appear, based on Theobald III, that would be the case.
Because you did not file in the Court of Claims before the statute ran.
Correct.
Right. And that's why you argue that 15C needs to be used to take a timely filed complaint. And 15C talks about if the university here knew about the case, knew that they might be the ones that could be considered to be liable, you could substitute them.
Correct.
Although it doesn't say that you can substitute which court you're in.
That is also correct.
So you're asking us to expand 15C to allow that substitution of which court you're in.
I am. And contrary to counsel for the Attorney General, and with all due respect to her opinions, I think that this body I'm standing before now certainly has that authority and that right.
Could you give us some authority that you would cite that would allow this court to use 15C to take the claim from a statutory jurisdiction to Court of Common, please?
Madam Chief Justice, I cannot give you a specific cite other than to say there are numerous cases that I would be happy to provide in a post-argument brief that say that it is the Supreme Court, that it is the final determiner, if you will, of the rules of procedure in all the courts of Ohio. And under that authority, I think that this court clearly has the right to determine how 15C should be applied. If the application I am suggesting is deemed an exception to the previous application or an expansion, if that's the term you prefer, so be it. I think it's well within the power and authority of this court to do so.
Mr. Fisher, does the Sawicki case help you at all, the state X. Rel. Sawicki versus Lucas County case, where we discussed dual agency and the issue of filing in common pleas and filing in the Court of Claims? Are you familiar with that case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does that help you in any way?
It does not, because in this instance, Dr. Skiskevich was, and I'll use the term tongue-in-cheek, he was a dinosaur in that he is a true solo practitioner. He did not practice through a corporate entity. There is no parent or other potentially responsible entity we could bring in through respondeat superior.
Had he had an independent corporation, though, you may be talking about that particular case.
Oh, absolutely. I would be.
All right. The issue the issue of control, we didn't talk — I didn't have a chance to ask Ms. Shermer the question, but whether the doctor is an employee. What was the university's activity pursuant to this doctor in whether the university could control the activities of the physician involved in the program?
As far as the evidence was developed in this case before the stipulations were agreed to, and including the stipulations, Dr. Skiskevich had no connection whatsoever to the University of Toledo Medical Center other than the fact that he served in the role as an appointed volunteer clinical professor. He was not a member of its private practice group. The record indicates nothing, and I'm aware of none outside of the record, that would indicate any additional or peripheral correlation between he and the university.
Thank you.
But he had to be approved by the university through a process that would allow for this physician to be in the position of a clinical instructor, even though it was voluntary.
Certainly that's correct. I do not know, and the record wasn't developed to the point to determine how extensive that process was.
Does it matter?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I haven't thought about that yet. It may. If it's just a rubber stamp, you know, we need someone out in Henry County, Dr. Skiskevich says he'll do it, and there's no real corresponding investigation or granting of privileges to the hospital itself, that may make a difference. But again, I haven't put a lot of thought to that.
But the argument made by the Attorney General seems to be that the physician involved here was not an employee of the university, but rather a volunteer.
That is their position.
And how do you respond to that position, and do you think that's the key issue for us to address here?
I think that the Attorney General's office is correct. Perhaps I get to the result through a different path.
You agree that this physician was not a university employee?
Absolutely. His relationship with the university had no indicia of employer-employee.
And it's your position, is that the key issue for us to decide here, his status?
Well, yes, but I don't think the issue is whether or not he was an employee, because I don't think the 10th District found him to be an employee. The 10th District was vague. It found him to be an officer or employee without defining which of those two terms.
So do you think he was an officer?
No, I do not.
Okay.
I agree with the Attorney General's office that clearly he was not an employee. There's no indication, no indicia of employment.
What was he?
He was a volunteer.
And was he instructing a medical student at the time of performing this surgery?
Yes.
And then does the statute then say if he was acting in furtherance of a state, was he acting in furtherance of a state interest in doing that?
I think he was, but I think that jumps over the threshold question of whether or not he was an officer or employee.
Well, now, I think trying to understand your argument as opposed to what the Attorney General is arguing to us. You don't think he was an employee and you don't think he was an officer?
No, sir.
And that's what the Attorney General thinks. So you agree on that?
Yes, except my perception of the Attorney General's office is that they were focusing on whether or not he was an employee. To the extent that they also are asserting that he was not an officer, yes, we are. I am in agreement.
And you think he was instructing a medical student at the time of this surgery?
Yes.
And he was acting in furtherance of a state interest at that point?
Yes.
And he was a clinical assistant professor at Medical College of Ohio?
That is correct.
Well, he wasn't performing the surgery for the student for teaching purposes, was he? He was performing the surgery and the student was incidental.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that's, I hope I brought that point home in my brief. Dr. Skiskevich was treating Larry Engel purely as a private patient in a private hospital. Whether the medical student made the drive from the Medical University of Toledo out to Bryan, Ohio to observe that surgery or not, the surgery was going to take place. It was scheduled. This student happened to drive out there and observe. I think it
that,
is.
That, but here's where I have trouble distinguishing Theobald from that. Same thing, private hospital, private patient. Theobald was in grave condition due to the accident. It was going to happen whether or not the resident was there or the nursing student who took a few notes. What I can't seem to understand is you took a different position below. You argued that he was immune. Is that right?
That is.
Why?
Why did I change my position? Or
no,
why did I
understand why you changed your position. Why did you argue that way below if your client's going to be out of court?
Well, I certainly didn't realize he might potentially be out of court at the time I took that position. Dr. Skoskevich happened.
When did you take that position?
When Theobald III came out.
But you start off in common pleas only against the doctor.
That is correct.
You didn't start off claiming. Then the doctor, right before trial, raised immunity.
Yes.
The court stayed the action, and then you refiled in court of claims. So
correct.
You had to do that because of the position the doctor took.
Yes, well after the running of the statute of limitations, okay. Including, not that it matters, including the 180-day extension, which was utilized in this case.
Okay.
It was well after. I would like to get to Justice Pfeiffer has already mentioned that we have proposed Civil Rule 15 might be applied, expanded, an exception made to remedy this situation. Another option I have proposed in our brief.
Counsel, if we don't do that, where does that leave you? Say you're in the position and the only thing that is going to save you is this court's extension of Rule 15C that would allow court-to-court transfers. Where does that leave you?
I'm afraid I'm missing the import of your question.
Well, I hear you say, and I could be wrong here, that it's necessary to your position for the court to expand on 15C.
No. That is one alternative I've offered in my brief. Another alternative, and I see I'm running short of time, I wanted to mention that initially this court rejected jurisdiction of this case. The Attorney General's office filed a motion for reconsideration, and in that motion for reconsideration, urged this court to make Engle prospective only, which is also certainly within the purview of the powers of this court. We agreed in our reply that, yes, go ahead and make Engle prospective only. Again, that was before I had knowledge of what Theobald III said and what its import was going to be. So to the extent that I asked this court to apply Engle to the parties inter se, we are changing our position on that as well. But secondly, the second alternative, Madam Chief Justice, I've offered is that I believe Theobald should be made prospective only, which is also well within the power and jurisdiction of this court, because as Justice Pfeiffer has pointed out, already Keith Theobald, Betty Clevenger, James Schultz, all plaintiffs with injuries, I know nothing about the merits of those cases, by the way, but they've all lost their day in court. Their right to a remedy was taken away through procedural maneuverings when they filed a case in the appropriate forum at the time the case was filed. That's the exact same position Larry Engle now finds himself in, and I ask this court, either through Civil Rule 15, the retroactive prospective application of Theobald being ordered, or simply making Engle prospective only and applying it to Larry Engle as well. Those are three ways that this court could, and then in addition to reversing the 10th District, there are four ways this court could salvage Larry Engle's case.
Mr. Fisher, if you could, I'd like you to, could you walk us through the forum selection problem that you have specifically in these types of cases?
Yes. At the time that this case came to my attention, I was advised Larry Engle was operated upon not at a state institution but at the Bryan Hospital, some, I think, 36 miles, according to MapQuest, from the University of Toledo Medical Center, by a private physician that I had no way to know or suspect was an appointed volunteer clinical professor. This court has even said in Theobald, and the 10th District has reiterated or has followed that, that a physician has no duty to tell a patient, you know, I work for the state. I'm an employee of the state. I'm an officer of the state. I'm going to be immune if I mess this up. There's no obligation, according to this court, to tell someone that. So Larry Engel certainly didn't know that. He had no reason to know that. In filing the case, I had no reason to suspect that. It wasn't well until after the case was filed and then the statute of limitations expired that discovery took place, and in the course of discovery, that information was learned. There needs to be the path to the Court of Claims is hidden with potholes and traps, and that ought not be the way the procedure in this state works. I don't know exactly what it is, and it's up to you justices to determine how an injustice like this that has already befallen upon three plaintiffs, whose names I've already mentioned, Larry Engel's case should be saved from a similar unfair fate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Sitterman, I will give you 2 minutes.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, thank you for allowing me to briefly speak on behalf of amicus curiae.
Excuse me, could you speak up so we can hear
sorry.
You?
Sorry. Dr. Suskevich, I would ask that the court look at the statute that's at issue here, the plain language of the statute that defines what an officer or an employee is. It does not allow or suggest that we can resort to other statutory definitions or to the common law. The statute here specifically defines officer or employee to include a position, a person who is appointed in a position, and an employee. Those are two disparate, separate things on either side of the or sign. Here, Dr. Suskevich was officially appointed, not by law, but by the university, which is created by law, which is a state institution. Having thus been appointed by the university and acting in the course of his officially assigned duties at the time of the care and treatment here, he was an officer or employee as the statute is defined.
Now, so if we accept what your position is in the pleadings, what we do then is we take what could be the liability of a private insurer and transfer that to the taxpayers of Ohio simply by some appointment of, if we believe the state, that he was, quote, not an appointed office. Your position would be that the approval of the trustees turns him into a state employee. Therefore, the private insurance carrier is not responsible for any liability, and the taxpayers of Ohio are.
Two answers. The first is that the difference we're talking about is here is voluntary and employee. You're talking about a volunteer who provides the same services as the employed staff does, and yet here he's not getting paid, and this is the best, the fairest position where the university should provide indemnity or the state should provide indemnity. But there are also commonplace, common sense ways to shift the risk that the university has already taken, which is you doctors that are not on our staff that we're not paying, but that are on our staff that we're not paying, that provide teaching to our students, we want you to add us to to your private insurance company as a named insured. That's going on. That's happening. It's no extra cost.
Well, counsel, I have one question,
yes,
about the definition. Looking at 109.362, officer or employee does not include any person elected, appointed, or employed by any political subdivision. And yet you're arguing that he was appointed?
The university is not a public is not a subdivision of the state, Your Honor. The university is a state institution. They specifically define political subdivisions are municipalities and such that are not entitled to immunity under the statute. The university is specifically contemplated to be subject to immunity under the statute. It's not a political subdivision. I am submitting that the doctor here was an officer as defined by the statute. The statute is not limited to employment in this case. If you look at subsections B and C, they talk about personal service contracts. Those individuals would probably be considered independent contractors. They're not employees of the university.
The negligence involved here really had nothing to do with the service to the university, did it? There's no allegation that the physician negligently instructed the student although if the allegations are true, that that might arise later, but it was negligent to the private patient.
That is true. None of that was developed because it was conceded that the physician here was engaged in instructing the student, was engaged in his function as part of the university. Exactly what the student was doing, whether he did assist or whether he was just standing there observing, was never really developed because there was no need to develop it within the context of the immunity issue. Nor was it developed before the Court of Claims. The judge was not given the opportunity to investigate all that. All that was dealt with here was a specific limited issue of directly, it's almost is it an employment or a volunteer? And if they're providing services in an appointed position through an institution, a state institution, then they fall directly within the plain language of the statute. And you don't need to go to the common law or to other statutes and to embellish on this statute.
Although, Ms. Zitterman, wasn't it in the nature of a shadowing process more than anything else that we're talking about here? When we're talking appointment as an officer, if we're not talking about university control over what he does, and as Justice Cupp said, he's conducting his practice, allowing a student to come in, it seems to me very different from what you're talking about.
That was not developed here.
Aren't we stuck with the stipulation that teaching was occurring
by
both parties?
Yes, Your Honor. That I would say. Thank you.
Ms. Schimmer, I don't recall that you reserved time, but I'll give you a minute.
Ms. Schimmer, I've been picking on you. Let me help you out a little with your argument for a moment.
Careful, Ms. Schimmer.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I believe you say in your brief there are 8,000 of these doctors, 6,000. How many is it?
About 8,000.
8,000 in the category of this doctor that out of, 13,500 physicians in this state, 8,000 of them, if we don't reverse the 10th district, will suddenly have all of their malpractice cases represented by the Attorney General in the Court of Claims. Is that correct?
I think the gist of that point, Your Honor, is basically correct, and I think
And what makes it worse is the direction the 10th District is headed, following Mr. Crawford's argument from the Attorney General's office previously, is to expand it to beyond where teaching was occurring. Now, here you've stipulated teaching was occurring, but they have some cases where they're saying, well, if you're in a practice plan, you've got to see a lot of patients, and even if no student is present, that could still be immune if you make a mistake.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think it's confusing the question in Theobald, which is the scope of employment, and the question
that,
of officer-employee.
I'm saying if we don't do what you want us to do and we bring them all in, we could conceivably be bringing in all of their mistakes that occur when no student is present.
You could, and I think that that's why the meaning of state officer under law has always been confined to positions that have been created by law. You don't want a situation where agencies and institutions are out there and wake up one morning and are told that, in fact, there are 8,000 additional people who are on their ranks who were never there. And that's why the definitions of those terms are constrained.
We're deciding the issue in this case today, and you're urging us to do it on that grounds. But if we think ahead a little bit, the next thing the universities do is to hire them for $200, and now they're going to allege that they're employees. So deciding this case today the way you suggest doesn't really solve the future potential issue of all of these 6,000 or 8,000 suddenly becoming state employees, does it?
Well, I think the ramifications, if you decide to affirm the 10th District, Your Honor, are that the university, given that it already has zero control over how these physicians practice medicine, will feel a need to start exercising that control, which is not something that is welcomed by the private physicians who serve this function, which is why they do consider themselves volunteer. The doctor here is an outlier. The private physicians who serve as volunteer instructors for the medical schools cherish and relish their status as private physicians. They do not want the state to have to come in and start doing all the things to exercise control that an immunity decision and grant would entail.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.